talking to David Hein and Fraser Irving. You two guys at the moment are working on a comic together, Silent War for Marvel, but you're also 2000 AD veterans, so I was hoping if we could kind of work our way between the two.
Yes, I'm a veteran, I'm a lot further back though. I can't even remember when it was, sometime in the 1850, something like that. No, the last trip I did was 1995, I think, Mambo. So what was there, three series of Mambo, Tale de Moto.
Yes.
And I did a couple of other things for other things like Crisis, Deadline, a few things like that. Then came the Wilderness years. yeah, did you want to say more about 2000 AD?
More than happy to, unless you don't want to. I mean, when you started Strange Embrace, was that before or after 2000 AD? Or was that the Wilderness years?
It was kind of in the middle. I took time off, because I've been doing some stuff for 2000 AD, but I really had ideas of what I wanted to do. And what I was doing for 2000 AD was just, you know, what 2000 AD was about. It was science fiction stuff. And I really wanted to do exactly what Strange Embrace turned out to be. And the only way I was going to get to do it was to take time off and say, you know, go and do it. And so I just stopped work. I didn't have a lot of expenses at the time, so I could actually do that. I had enough money saved to take a year off. And went away and wrote it. And that was the time when Tundra UK, Atomica, was going. And Dave Elliott saw the first, I think I drew up like 10 pages of it, and I had the whole script written. And he bought it for Tundra straight away. No editorial interference whatsoever, which is just what I wanted. And after that, I get a bit, it all kind of blurs a bit, but I think it was after that I went back and did a bit more stuff for 2000 AD. Then got totally fed up and went and did illustration for 10 years. Those were the Wilderness years. But I worked a lot less and got paid a lot more. So
You're saying that comics isn't a glamorous and highly paid?
Oh, yes. I hate to be the one to reveal that, but
it is glamorous.
Is this glamorous? Is this glamorous? No.
Okay.
I mean, I would describe it as a lot of things. It's intimate and it's friendly and it's warm. It's a warm gathering of people.
That's just Bristol.
But
when you go to San Diego, on the other hand, and you've got the sun, you've got like so many people in really good costumes, very beautiful people just wandering around, and such a wide variety of like crazy things. And the way they treat us, the creators, I'm sitting just at a table, and it's people who are kind of like giving me the same kind of adulation and worship that my other friends would give to their favourite rock stars or actors. My girlfriend even looks at me and says, "I'm so proud to have a comic book artist boyfriend." And I'm like, bingo.
This is complete bollocks.
This is true. It's absolutely true. Every single word of it.
Either that or we should be trying harder here. Sorry.
The thing is, like, I think it's what you make of it, really. It's like, you know, some people just want to do the work, stay at home. Some of them want to, you know, create a glamour, as some writers would say.
And that's you.
No, I'm only creating half a glamour. That's because why I wear the hats, you know. But there are certain people who actually do go out of their way to make themselves more mysterious, more enigmatic, so they have this cult set of followers who elevate them on a pedestal. And that's glamorous to a certain degree. And we get to travel the world. On our own ticket, of course. But it means it gives me a reason to go around the world and stay in hotels and claim it back on tax, because that's what it is, business expense. So I think it is glamorous to a certain degree.
Well, I mean, as glamorous as working for 2000 AD can be, I mean, they paid you a pretty good accolade recently by releasing a collection of your work in a book together.
Sorry?
So, I mean, if there's anything you wanted to say about the Fraser Irving collection.
Okay, well, the Storming Heaven, the collective works of Fraser Irving, known by its full title, is a...
I bought it.
Yeah, really?
I did.
Hey, nice one.
I should have got a free copy.
Did you get a signed copy?
No, that's true. I haven't signed it, but I will. Carry on.
Okay, well, I was really pleased about that, mainly because I've seen collections where it's like the writer's name, and then, you know, the artist is always second to the writer. You know, "Yes, thank you, master. Give me your story. I will scribble upon it." and I get my 5 pages in a collection. Yeah, this time they decided to say, let's make, you know, the other guy, kind of top dog, and have the writers playing second fiddle. And so it's a victory for every artist in the business saying, yeah, an artist's collection. In terms of like the book itself, I was just so chuffed to see all these kind of different ideas I've been working on together to prove that, you know, that variety is the spice of life. You know, you don't want a book of everything looking the same, because then you don't know what page you're on. But with this, you know when you finish Storming Heaven and you're reading A Love Like Blood, because the style is different. And it means like it's something else, something new for you to explore. Now, I bought, like at cost, a box of 30, so I can either give them away or sell them at some point. But my greatest wish is that, you know, after San Diego, 2000 AD, we'll get this book to the American public, because I know they will like the content. Stories like Storming Heaven will go down a storm over there, pardon the pun. Reefer Madness, will hit very heavily like the West Coast audience. They will love this, and because they don't know 2000 AD is about that. They think it's just Judge Dredd and Rogue Trooper and Jumpers for Goalposts. It does have a very, very old-fashioned image over there. But if they show them my book, which has got loads of Americanisms all over it, I think they'll appreciate it. And I mean, I've just got to wait and see whether they actually kind of like bite, and they've got to be able to get a copy. Yeah, I'm deeply chuffed with that book.
And obviously Shaun of the Dead went down a storm as well in America.
Yeah, okay,
or at least within the community.
Shaun of the Dead is really popular in America. Simon Pegg is, you know, they love him. He's like the new Hugh Grant, you know. He doesn't have the floppy hair, but he's funny and he can act. But there was it, Hot Fuzz, when that was released over when I was in Canada, everyone wanted to see it. So when I said, yeah, I did a Shaun of the Dead strip twice, you know, all of a sudden they were interested. Now, it's definitely not the best piece in the book. I mean, it was something done as a movie tie-in. It wasn't like, you know, a work in itself, like all the other stories. But if I can use that to get people interested, you know, it's almost like having, like, the words free sex on the front of a magazine, you know? It's like, hey, I'll buy it for that, and then I'll hopefully find something good inside. But, I don't know. Come on.
So, Shaun of the Dead and a few longer things by.
No, I mean, I wouldn't want to actually sell the book based on that, because I think people would buy it expecting comedy and zombies. And we do have comedy and zombies, but that's only a small part of it. I mean, we have From Grace in it, which is Simon's, you know, deep, disturbing, kind of like, you know, emo epic. And that, in itself, kind of really sets off everything else. You know, it makes the superheroes look even more glamorous. It makes the marijuana zombies seem even more crazy and retro. It sets off A Love Like Blood to look even like more like, you know, a Hollywood knockoff. And it's like, you know, this is the kind of like variety that I want to send out in the world, and that I would like to read. So it's got my name on it as well. It's got my face on the spine. It's like having a child without having to change nappies or anything. Or pay child support.
Comparing, I suppose, is it fair to say that perhaps with 2000 AD as an anthology title, you get a chance to do one genre, another genre, reinvent, play around, and then when it moves to the States, it's like, oh, we like you doing this, we'll get you doing lots more of it for more money over here? Or
actually, no, that wasn't the case, funnily enough. The first American job I got was doing Fort, Prophet of the Unexplained, for Dark Horse, and they just said, like, yeah, we want you to do it in your black and white style, because that's all I did at that time. Then when Wildstorm approached me and said, we'd like you to do The Authority, I'm like, why me? That's as crazy as picking Richard Corbin. And he actually said, I would love to have Richard Corbin do The Authority. Which made me realise that some American editors, not publishers per se, but editors, do want to shake the tree. And since then, every job I've done, I've actually said to the editor at the beginning, by the way, I'm going to be doing it in this kind of style, and I'll describe it verbally, and let them have every images in their head. And I think they're happy with this. The only time I've actually had to stick with one style is when I did 2 issues of Robin, which had Clary on the Witch Boy starring. And I had to use the same style, the same character, it's continuity. But any other story, it's up for grabs. And I think so far, every editor has been happy with that. So that's the way it should work, I think.
Is that what you found, Dave? It's easy.
It was completely different for me because I broke into the American market through Strange Embrace. So I it still seems like a miracle to me that Joe Quesada, Red Strange Embrace, and turned around and said, this is the guy who should be writing Marvel superhero books. I still, that's a leap of logic that is a mystery to me. But I did feel, I guess I started off writing in District X, is the first book that I wrote, as probably the most personal thing that I've done for Marvel to date. I think there was a period, and it's not that long ago, was it 3 years ago, where Marvel really seemed to be opening up to bringing in people who were not just coming up through the ranks of comics. They were looking to... I think there's even a couple of playwrights who came on board. There were novelists, people from TV and movies. And in a sense, I was seen as being outside of the comics mainstream as well. And to begin with District X, I was certainly given my head, pretty much. You know, I was actually allowed to write a Marvel book that didn't have spandex and that didn't have a lot of fight scenes. And similarly, that was followed with Daredevil Redemption, which is actually the first book that I pitched for Marvel. That was a story that I'd had kind of simmering for several years. And it wasn't conceived as a Daredevil story at all. It was simply a murder mystery and a courtroom drama. And it seemed obvious to me this was a Matt Murdock story. And I was actually allowed to do it pretty much as a courtroom drama, without too much of the fisticuffs. And there were complaints, of course. The problem is that these books did not sell fantastically well, particularly Daredevil, that sales were actually fairly low. But it's the book that I'm most proud of. But there were a lot of people who said, so where's Daredevil? You know, there was one entire issue 5, where there was no Daredevil in costume at all. It was purely Matt Murdock. But, you know, it's an aspect of the character that I really, really wanted to explore.
As Andy Diggle and Jock were talking earlier about, was it Green Arrow year one, saying there's zero spandex. Now, that went down well here because I think, you know, Britain kind of likes that approach to things. We're not a spandex country. But
I know for a fact that there are so many people in the industry who do actually want to do stuff that is away from the superhero books. And that includes every editor I've ever spoken to at Marvel, every creator I've ever spoken to at Marvel. And it's this weird thing that if everybody wants to do other genres, and yet we all end up doing superheroes. Because after District X and Daredevil Redemption, I gradually slid, and you may have noticed this, slid into more and more costumed X-books. That culminated with Civil War X-Men. And at that point, I really felt that I was going in a direction that I was not suited for, apart from anything else. Which is why I've kind of drawn back from those kind of, particularly crossover books. And I'm very happy with Son of M and then Silent War, which, although they're costumed heroes, but they're kind of not. You know, because I don't see the Inhumans as a bunch of superheroes at all.
Yeah, and with the Civil War, I mean, it seemed that yes, there were all these folk in spandex running around, but then there was this massive dose of politics that comes in, quite contemporary stuff, which again makes the headlines. But it's almost that was the unexpected thing that, you know, oh, it's another crossover. Oh no, wait a minute, it's not another crossover. It's almost like the whole thing was expressing a bit of an opinion or getting into that kind of debate, which isn't, I suppose, what you might have expected from Marvel or DC or the big American publishers that recently.
Yeah, I'm not sure how sophisticated the politics were in the end, though, because
Well, I mean, the 198 felt like one of the more political comics that Marvel's done in recent years.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking about people basically being interned. I mean, to me, it was a parallel of what happened to Japanese in the United States during the Second World War. I guess that, and to me also, of course, what's happening in Guantanamo Bay Bay. I mean, that's an obvious parallel. The problem with Civil War is, to me, in theory, I would have been in favour of registration, because I'm not. If you want the Marvel Universe to be realistic, then it is absolutely absurd for mass vigilantes to be going around beating people up and acting completely outside the law, making up their own minds what's right, what's wrong, who's good, who's bad. Totally insane. So yes, register the bastards. Obvious. But then, of course, Iron Man starts putting people away without trial in the negative zone and all this stuff. And I think that didn't really give that side of the argument a lot of weight in the end. Everybody was on Captain America's side. You know, how could you not be? Because Stark's a fascist bastard, you know. And that shouldn't have been the argument. I think it could have had been more subtly nuanced than it was in the end. I think Joe Sud himself made some good points. I remember being at a convention talk where he said, how would you feel if there were masked guards standing at the door today? Because that's essentially what superheroes are doing. So I'd have liked to have seen it pursued a little more along those lines.
I mean, it seems that it's British creators that are doing the more sort of edgy stuff, even in the superhero genre in American comics. Do you think it's just that the Americans feel that it's a bit of a get-out clause, that if you guys do something that's disliked by the fans, it's just the Brits being controversial, even though they commissioned it? Would you like to ruminate?
Yes, I'll ponder that one. I don't know. I actually think that... I tend to think there's actually a class thing, which is something that people don't talk about a lot, except for me. I always bring it up. But I actually think that a lot of the British writers are actually coming from a fairly politicised and often working class background. We can talk about things like socialism. And all American creators are middle class. I have yet to meet an American creator who doesn't come from a very comfortable middle class background. I think that does inform their attitudes. I mean, I can't imagine anyone really aspiring to socialist principles in America who's working in comics. They still have that. There's almost a frisson about the word socialist means communist in America. You know, there's no differentiation between those two terms. So, I actually think, you know, people like Alan Moore, very working class backgrounds, he is always going to go out there and be a little bit edgy. I just think probably the American creators have never had it hard enough to be angry enough to actually have a reason to be edgy.
I mean, and also another thing about British creators doing American comics is their stuff's a little bit more kind of off the wall. So I was thinking things that that you've drawn, like Grant Morrison's Clary and the Witch Boy, and as well as, Frasier's Silent War, which is presumably the Inhumans taking on the Marvel Universe, because I haven't read it yet. But, is there anything you'd like to say on that?
I'm not entirely sure whether British artists have the same kind of relationship with the industry as British writers do, because I think British writers have got a voice which is all their own, and also because most of them have been either weaned on or worked on 2000 AD, because you have to work with 5-page installments, you have to be really ruthless with your stories, and the editors have been notoriously harsh, saying this isn't cruel or funny enough. You know, they don't allow you to be lazy. Or don't allow the writers to be lazy. But the artists, on the other hand, I think the first chance they get, they will ape the American style as much as possible. It's very glitzy, very shiny, very clean. And I always see up-and-coming artists show me their samples modelled on American art, which is now basically either the old-school stuff, which is like brush work, from the 70s or the 80s, or the image stuff from the early 90s, which is the Rob Liefeld stuff. I don't see anyone ripping off the Filipino artists of the 70s. I don't see anyone ripping off people like Cy Davis, Cy Fraser, or the Europeans. And it's like, the artists in England, in my experience, tend to want to be American. You know, we're from the same kind of background as the writers, And I think it's actually our desperation and our hunger, thinking if we draw like the Americans, then we'll make more money. Personally speaking, I kind of got away from that by going to art school. I mean, they didn't teach me anything per se, but it exposed me to a wide variety of things. And then after I left college, after going through a bit of a Dave McKean phase, I looked at my own work. I thought, if I mix the somewhat juvenile, kind of glitzy, kind of 70s Marvel Comics style, which I would really like to have drawn, with some of these crazy, scratchier things and stuff which use silhouettes in all the wrong places, and mix it, I could come up with something which is my own, which effectively turns out to be British, because I am in England. So I'm quite proud of the fact that everything I do has caused some controversy with the readership initially, because they're like, this isn't what we normally want. This is what we want, Fraser. We want something that looks like this, with square jaws and perfect women. You can't have characters looking like dirty old men. I'm really proud of the fact that when Silent War started, there were certain people who were calling, you know, for my head, saying, you know, they made Black Bolt look ugly and old and disturbing. And now, after three or four issues, some of those same people are saying, I've really got used to the idea of Black Bolt having emotion in his face and looking like a ruler. Because he is going to have like a worried face. Politicians don't look grey and wrinkled for any reason other than the fact that they are always worrying. Always worrying and stressed because people hate them and they want to kill them. Oh no, I only make 30 grand a year kind of thing. Black Bolt's going to have the same kind of crap. So therefore that goes into the character. And I would like to see, like, you know, a slow change. Not a drastic change because it's too much. But I'd like to see a slow change in American comics where you can broaden what is accepted in terms of art. I mean, Richard Corbin doing Hellblazer and doing Ghost Rider is a beautiful thing to see, because he would never have been considered that in the 80s. But that's not enough, because he's still his own little thing. It's kind of like, you know, it's like, it's a Richard Corbin comic. But it should be a case where, like, you know, someone draws a story about the Silver Surfer, they should really get into the kind of the Jesus complex of this armor. It should glow, it should glisten. The stars should be twinkling on the pages. It shouldn't be bits of Tippex drawn on black ink with a guy with like kind of Jack Kirby lines on the body. That's rubbish. But I know quite a lot of British writers and some American writers, but my affinity is with this lot. Probably because, as David said, from a very similar background, and we're all angry. But I know that, you know, if someone lays down like a check and says, will you draw in this style for this character for this amount of money, the artists are always the first ones to go, yeah, no problem. I can always draw something else in my spare time. Whereas the writers tend to be a bit more principled. We're definitely more the horse.
That's not necessarily true. I mean, I did my wilderness years were spent doing things like drawing for Maxim magazine as my main client for the last 5 years, probably. So I wouldn't, you know, I don't claim high principles. I just claim a bit of anger, which you grow up with, and you never forget it. Even when you actually start making a decent living,
also,
you still feel poor, you know.
I think a very important factor in the development of the British comic industry is that we have the Dole. Now the Dole is good because it allows you certain time off to kind of, like, you know, kind of reflect and do your own thing, perfect your skills. As I did, for the 2 years I was, two separate individual years I was on the Dole, I was genuinely working towards improving my career. Thank you, I paid all my money back in taxes now, they can leave me alone. But...
Well, not only that, I mean, I didn't have to pay to go to art school, I don't know about you.
No, I got full grant, which was pretty good at the time.
I mean, I'd take a bloody student loan, you know, I was in debt by the time I left college. But the thing was, it's like, the student loans, the grants and the Dole, although they give you that time, they also come with it, the exchange of, like, you are going to be considered to be a lower human being in the eyes of the rest of society. You're going to learn what it's like to be rejected. Like, you're Dole scum. You're a freeloader. You're a student. You're a draft dodger. And I think that, in many respects, you know, some people just can't handle it, and they have to get a regular job because they can't take the abuse they're taking from people's eyes looking at them, yeah? Signing in that line on every 2 weeks. And I think it's... Other countries had the same kind of welfare system. They probably breed very similar creatives. But we don't. We're allowed to sit in our pot and stew. And I think it's because this country works well like that. Musicians, great musicians have come out of England, and a lot of them were on the Dole at the time. And, you know, they pay it all back. And they probably subsidise the rest of us as well, you know. But I have to say thank you for the welfare system. I hope never to return to it. But yeah, it did me wonders. I speak very good things of it.
And we're back to socialism and British comics again.
Yeah, it's power to the people.
It's going back to the senses. Did David specify a specific Irving style to draw Silent War?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. No.
God forbid.
No, it came as a great shock to me. I mean, originally, Silent War was a follow-up to Son of M, and I was writing it with Roy Martinez in mind. So the first issue was basically written for Roy. But for whatever reasons, Roy couldn't do the book, and Fraser came on. So that first issue, I don't know how comfortable Fraser felt with it, but I had no idea really what it was going to look like. I'd seen some of Fraser's work, but it was, yeah, that was a complete unknown. By the time I was writing issue two, I was writing for Fraser. So I don't know if that's actually going to be apparent to people reading the book. I do always try to write with the artist in mind, and you know that people have different strengths. I think Roy was seeing the Inhumans as a much more cooler, sophisticated group of people. Fraser is seeing them as demented, and which is the way I wanted to go with the book anyway. You know, I do want to do some pretty dreadful things with the Inhumans, which is annoying some people and pleasing others. I think what we've done with, especially Medusa, I love what Fraser has done with that character, and it's expressionism, pure expressionism, really, because. You know, taking that hair, the things that he's done with that hair are just out of this world. Love it.
Yeah, as I say, it's like, as I've always maintained, I kind of misquote Steve Dillon when, like, someone once asked him in an interview, what kind of thing do you want to draw, expecting him to say the Hulk or Superman? And he said, just tell me a good story. And I heard this years ago, and I found out now that if the script has drama and the script has, like, some kind of emotional engagement, then the artwork has it. But if it doesn't have that, then the artwork is going to be sterile as well. You can't force it. And when reading David's stories, when I can see that certain characters are going to go through a downward spiral, or something dramatic is going to happen to them, a major life change, then I can't help but reflect that in the artwork. So when the first few times I drew Medusa, she was like, she was just a chick with red hair. Because that's how she was introduced into the story. She was a blank icon. She'd been the same for many years, but we're going to change her. So when the couple of key scenes happened, when I'm drawing it, it's happening in front of me without me knowing it, because there's a story for me to tell. So now, when we end with issue, like the end of issue 5, you see her in a certain light, which is like extremely dark. But the thing is, it's not dark in a kind of the Crow kind of way. It's not kind of dark in an Evanescence kind of way. It's not kind of glamorous dark. It's a dark which is very uncomfortable, and it shouldn't be that way. She's not a glamorous dark character, and she shouldn't be like this forever. She should redeem herself at some point, unlike Wolverine, who lives to be dark and mean. But when what happens to her, it's like, you know, it was all in the text, you know. She kisses Maximus, it says, and it's like, I know what this means. This means a huge betrayal. And the thing is, we had the Avengers guest starring in an issue I just done, in issue 5. And they had no real kind of like dramatic kind of changes to make. So they kind of enter the stage left. They're going to go, I'm Iron Man, I'm Ms. Marvel, I'm Wonder Man. And they stand there in their comic book poses, do their things, and then they leave the stage right.
Did you enjoy drawing that?
I have to say, no, I mean, obviously, they were a tool, and not a tool in an American way. They were kind of a, pardon me, they were a device to kind of like move the story on. And they served their function, you know. Ms. Marvel didn't act any more than she needed to, because the main star was Black Bolt, the main star was Gorgon. When the scenes with Gorgon, as he's changed, I mean, I turned him into a monster, based on David's descriptions. Now, when I draw this woolly mammoth thing with his ridiculous mouth and his really long fingernails, that's a part of me in there. And it's like, I can draw him doing anything now. But drawing supporting characters, they know their place, you know. So like, if we obviously when we get to the bits where it's like stuff is happening, even if it's between two characters or 100, if they're all going through changes, then you're going to have a very, very vibrant page. And I have to say, like, I mean, I didn't really notice any difference in the script in the first issue and later on in terms of who David was writing for. All I can say was that certain words like regal and like, I don't know, noble and stuff like that would stop featuring. Do you know what I mean? Because like I saw Son of M and I could see what he was doing. Black Bolt stood with his head high. He was proud. He was like, you know, he's a peacock. His barrel chest with all his muscles rippling. My Black Bolt is a shadow. He is an enigma within a puzzle, within a rhyme. He's also incredibly frustrated. So therefore, that has to show some little way. You know, he's not regal anymore. Some readers might want him to be regal, they might want him to be a king. He's not a one-dimensional character, despite what the naysayers of the comic book world will say. You know, superheroes and those kind of characters aren't one-dimensional unless you write them one-dimensionally. And I really want to show a side to each of these characters. Even Crystal, who's had a very, very tiny bit in this, where like she kind of does her bit to push the story along, but her own personal journey has been happening for years. You know, if she goes through a very key moment, I don't know what happened in, if we do a sequel, I don't know what could happen to her. If she goes through something very intense and important, then her visuals will change to reflect that. And I just wait for those moments now. It's like, I have to say, it's possibly one of the more engaging scripts I've worked on because of, like, you know, the issues of, like, infidelity and, like, betrayal and failure and despondency and self-loathing. Oh!
I have to interrupt you and make a protest, Fraser. You're far too articulate for an artist. I'm supposed to be doing all this stuff. But I agree with everything you said. Now, for me, obviously, every story has to have conflict. Conflict is the heart of the story, and the problem with an awful lot of, I guess, with partly with our audience and partly with the medium we're working in, is that a lot of people see the literal conflict as being the most important. We've had war as the title of so many series recently. I didn't actually choose the title of Silent War, but I think that says it all for the series. What I'm interested in is the conflicts that are going on internally. It's the emotional conflicts. I find nothing personally more boring than big fight scenes. And I have written a couple. It may be that I'm not the right person to write fight scenes because I find them boring. But for me, the drama that we've had between you know, characters like Medusa and Black Bolt and Maximus, and with Pietro and his daughter Luna in the previous series, that's far more interesting to me. That's the conflicts that I'm interested in, and which I think we're starting to get through. What we're doing is finding our audience. There are people who are getting totally pissed off and say, I'm not buying this crap, and there are other people who are starting to who wouldn't have been buying these books and are now starting to pick it up and really get into it. And I've been getting to, I mean, today I've been sitting here signing at my table all day, and the number of people are coming up and saying Silent War is cool. It's fantastic. It's more a better response than I've had to, I think, anything else I've done. So that's very gratifying. I think we're finding that audience, and it may be smaller than the audience for Civil War, but it's definitely there.
I'll ask this as politely as possible. Talking of two-dimensional monsters that get into fights and have really complicated backstories, what's it like writing Spawn?
No, Spawn is a joy to me, actually. I know an awful lot of people kind of go like, oh, Spawn, oh my God. But it's a terrific character, always was. And of course, moving on to Spawn, there was a huge weight of, I don't know quite the word is. There was so much product out there. I was taking on what is, I do actually believe that is one of the iconic characters of the last 20 years.
Well, and also Todd obviously made efforts over the years to get the likes of Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, and Dave Sim writing issues.
Yeah, that's right. There have been an awful lot of very good writers there. Brian Bendis as well has worked on Sam and Twitch. But it was great for me because Todd is such a hands-off person. He literally said to me, I think what he actually says, make me look bad. You know, go and do something that's, do whatever you want and just make it better than what I've been doing. Which is, he had a very, very generous attitude, which a lot of people seem to get the wrong impression about Todd McFarlane. And he'll say himself, yes, he's got a big ego, but he's also quite objective about the way he is. He's very generous to his creators. So it was a tough book to take over because there are 150 issues that I had to read for a start and try and make sense of all the very, very complex backstory, as you say. But I think we made a good job of it. I started off working with Phil Tan. We did a 16 issue arc which built up to Armageddon. First thing we wanted to do, we wanted to go with a new direction, and Todd would have been happy to go straight into the horror stuff that we're doing now. But I did feel that we owed it to the fans that have stuck with the book for 15 years, whatever it is, to not just drop everything, to actually follow through with all the plot lines that have been built up over those years, and to deliver something. You know, it's always been built into Armageddon, so it's a, let's just deliver. And then, can we do it? Can we destroy the world? Can we wipe out the human race and then do something that isn't just setting the clock back and saying either, oh, it never happens, turning back time, it was an imaginary story, whatever. No, we did destroy the world. We destroyed the human race. And then Spawn reconstructed the world, but it's a flawed version. And from there, we've just gone into this completely new direction. Gwen Hadlin has taken over as artist, with, for the first time really on the monthly book, with a style that is completely different from what Todd was doing. And he's very happy with that, we're very happy with it. So yeah, as a creative experience, it's been good so far, and I think it's going to carry on being.
Anything else you want to add? Brilliant, thanks ever so much.
Thank you.